is Rhode Island's longest-running financial talk show, Money Talk with Don Soa. Taking care of business and working overtime. With market insights and so much more, talk to Don now at 437-5000 or 1-888-345-0790. This is Money Talk with Don Soa.
And we welcome you to the Money Talk program, everybody. I'm Don Soa. You're listening to AM 790, your home of talking business, and this is Money Talk. The number to call if you've got a question for me on air is 437-5000 or 888-345-0790. That's the toll-free number. That's 888-345-0790. Locally, 437-5000. Brett's the producer. He's here. He's taking calls. If you're in a safe place where we don't have to worry about chatting with you, certainly let us know that, and we'll get you on the air. If it's a little bit dubious, a little questionable, just give me your question, and he'll plug it into my screen, and he'll make sure that I address it during the course of the program and try to get it to you before you reach your destination. I want to thank my daughter on Tuesday. She filled it entirely for me. We do the Get Back to Basics program together on Tuesday. But this is one of those weeks. I mean, when you get grandkids, they bring home just about everything from school, and between colds and flus, I certainly am among them, and I caught that, and I literally had no voice left, and so she just carried the ball for me. We do appreciate that, and I'm just slowly but surely getting my voice back, so I'll kind of take it easy here with you tonight, but we do have a lot of interesting and important things to discuss with you as the week goes on and we get closer to the end of February, and a little over a full month now under a new President Trump administration. But you know, the markets have been reflective. They've called it the Trump rally. We're seeing a lot of movement to the upside in the markets. A lot of volatility, but still the general direction for the markets is up. Stocks closed mixed today. We had remarks that came out from the newly minted Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin. Investors, of course, are looking for more than just remarks. They're looking for details. One of the things that we've suffered from in this past political campaign, and this is not just Donald Trump, but it's also other parties as well, including Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, is that for all the broad statements and all the wonderful general ideas, there was not a lot of meat on the bone, and we could not get much in the way of details. And in the world of investing, because we know we're taking some risks to be investors, we want to make sure we have as much information as we possibly can. And right now, we're getting some direction, but not a lot of that detail. And that's why you're still seeing some nervousness in the market, even though there tends to be a bit of a general consensus that confidence among consumers and investors tends to be relatively good right now. Investors are getting more cautious, however, as the market gets higher and higher. 20,000 was that magic number to break through on the Dow. Well, now we broke through 20,800 today, so we're at another all-time high. I wouldn't take this as any kind of a major shift out there, at least not in market direction. The market seems to be, you know, having good days, bad days, but the overall number of days that are good are more. The Dow gained 34 points to set a 10th straight record close. Johnson & Johnson contributed probably the most to the Dow today. The S&P 500 ended, pretty flat, little changed, with industrials dropping, the industrial sector itself dropping around 0.8%. NASDAQ was the underperformer in this case. The tech sector, tech-heavy area, slid about 0.43%. We had pretty much a 50-day winning streak in the tech sector for us. So this is the first time it snapped that winning streak. Now, that doesn't mean that it won't continue higher, but we're just saying that we've seen a lot of consistency on the NASDAQ side. So watching both the S&P and the Dow go higher today and then the NASDAQ pull back might have been a little bit of a surprise, but it shouldn't be too much. You've got the economy improving kind of on its own, even without tax reform, according to Bruce Biddles. He's a strategist with Baird. I think that we keep going higher until we get, some sort of indication. In other words, the market tends to move on speculation and rumor and then settles in, adjusts to the levels that it should be at based upon reality, based on the news, as they say. So buy on the rumor, sell on the news. Or perhaps buy on speculation and sell or settle in, on reality. I think we keep going higher. Then the market might at some point top out and decide it's time to have some sort of a market pullback. But the market's been doing very, very well. The question that some analysts do have is whether or not a lot of the points we've seen so far in the various indices that make up the market, whether these points are reflective of simply expectation of perhaps tax cuts, major tax reform, spending on infrastructure here in the United States, as well as major reforms in regulation. Now, granted, that's all part of the Trump agenda. What the timing is of all these major campaign promises. I mean, the president seems determined as best he can to keep his campaign promises. But the issue that he can't promise, I mean, he can say, yes, I'm going to do this, but he can't tell you exactly when. He can't tell you the speed with which things get done, and he can't tell you the full scope either, because he's going to require to do some of the major things that he has on his plate, his bucket list. He requires the support as well as the financing, and that's the financial side from Congress. They got to pay the bills, and he could come up with a great idea, he could come up with a plan, but in the end, it's Congress that pays for it. But anyway, in the end, they're looking back at a number of different issues that are part of that. We did see on CNBC today, Mnuchin, the new Treasury Secretary, said that he wants to see significant tax reform passed before Congress's August recess. I think that that's pretty ambitious. He suggested that we want to get this done by that August recess, and he says that his teams have been working closely with the leadership of the House and the Senate, and we're looking at a combined plan of some sort. The prospect of a tax reform has been one of the key catalysts in the U.S. stock market's post-election rally that we've been enjoying all this time, along with, as I mentioned, government spending on infrastructure and deregulation. There's been a lot of hope and a lot of expectation built into the market. This has been a sort of a buy-high, sell-higher market. We kind of were more comfortable normally with buy-low, sell-high, but we started out already at a fairly high level. The indexes that we tend to follow are at all-time highs. That doesn't mean that they're overly expensive. They're really not. I mean, the long-term average for the S&P 500, if you look at the P.E. ratio, the standard metric that we use for expense in the market, it's usually around 17 or 18. And right now we're in that 20-21 range. I mean, that's higher than average, but it's not necessarily suggesting that it's overblown. I can remember back in 1999, early 2000, at the end of a major bull market in the technology bubble era, as we're about to enter into a 30-month bear market, we were looking at P.E. ratios on these same indices that were well into the 40s. There were individual stocks out there in the tech sector that were actually in triple digits, which is really insane. But that's the way that it was. And we did have, even then, Alan Greenspan, the Fed chair, suggesting that we had entered into a period of irrational exuberance. The first time we'd heard that phrase used that way in that context. And we're not hearing too many people talking that way now. But there are some people suggesting that the market is priced for perfection, which means that, you know, we're not seeing necessarily an overpriced market yet. The market is not cheap. That means in order to get much higher prices than we're seeing now, we need to see some substantial reasons to believe that there will be growth of earnings. And, of course, that means that a great many of the plans on that bucket list that the president has, a great many of them have to come to fruition. Some of them have to come true, in other words. And what percentage that happens and at what level that occurs will have a lot to do with just how good a year we have overall here in 2017. As I said, higher markets, higher numbers, in a large part so far, we've been able to justify these numbers. Managing director over at U.S. Bank, a private client reserve, a guy named David Scheigeli, and he suggests that when reality does hit, that's when markets actually might revalue themselves, reprice themselves, as a polite way of saying correct. And a correction only has to be a move of 10% or so from the high. U.S. Treasuries and gold prices, considered some traditional safe haven assets, also went up today as following Mnuchin's interview. The benchmark 10-year note yield fell to 2.38%, while the short-term 2-year note slipped to 1.19. Gold futures for the month of April settled about $18.10 per ounce higher. So we're sitting right in at around $1,251 per ounce right now, you know, on the April contracts. Now, there's an incredible amount of skepticism out there, especially for a market that keeps just making new highs. No, I mean, I don't know. Would people feel better if there was a big pullback? Well, there are some analysts who feel that in order to move dramatically higher off the numbers we're looking at now, it would probably be at least intermittently good to have some sort of a pullback, even if it's only in a 4 to 6% range. We've seen years where that did, in fact, happen, where you had multiple periods during the course of the year where you had not corrections. A 10% move is a correction, but what they say, pullbacks, a pullback of 2 to 3, 2 to 4, even 2 to 5%. There can be multiple pullbacks during the course of a year based upon volatility and activities that are occurring during the course of the year. When there's an awful lot of uncertainty, that can occur. But those things are fairly normal. And a good example of how volatile markets can be is back in 2015. Back in October of that year, the market dropped 13.3%. Yet by the end of the year, it had recovered most of that, and it finished down for the year, but it was down 3.3. So it recovered 10% of its 13.3% decline. So that's a very short period of time to have that kind of a recovery. So anybody who got all worked up about it and sold off after the sell-off lost out on the opportunity of watching it recover almost all of its value, you know, only within a couple of months. People keep focusing on the president and paying a lot more attention on his missteps, the things they think he's doing wrong, rather than looking at the bigger picture, which is that the world economy, and that includes the U.S. economy, is improving. It has been improving all along. It has been a rather extraordinary last several years, actually. It's not a mess. We understand. We're used to the president's rhetoric. We get it. Everything's a mess. Everything he inherited was a mess. I think most people who actually follow the economy, who understand how it works, know that it was not a mess. The last time it was a mess was actually the fourth quarter of the year 2008. We had a global market meltdown. The credit markets froze up. There was no money moving anywhere, and it basically frozen. And it was really the aggressive moves that were made by the incoming administration, and quite frankly, efforts made as part of the setup by the outgoing George W. Bush administration and his people. They set it up, and Barack Obama, our president, the incoming president back in early 2009, he picked up the ball and he ran with it, and it was a slow, stable, not too impressive, but continuous recovery, growing at about the 2% range, 2% GDP for the next 7 or 8 years. It was a very long, dragged-out recovery. The market went up with it. The market reflected that. It's been, if you were an investor and you were investing in a well-diversified portfolio that was weighted in stocks, you probably did very well from 2009 through 2016. And, of course, you're continuing to do so here into 2017. A lot of the rapid movement that we're looking at right now is suggestive of the promise of what is to come. And we'll be watching that very, very closely. This is Don Sowey. You're listening to Money Talk on AM 790. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. And we're back to the Money Talk program, everybody. I'm Don Sowey. Delighted to have you here with me on AM 790. I mentioned in the earlier segment that there's a lot of good, solid economic data out there, a lot of which shows a continuation of an improving economy that has really been doing so over the last couple of years. I'm not critical of the president for trying to position economic data and economic opinion as negatively as possible, because that's how you get elected president. I mean, that's what every candidate has done before him, so why would he do any differently? And the nice thing is for a person who's trying to, you know, win people's support and vote, of course, is that all you need to do when you offer an opinion is put a little piece of truth in it. It doesn't have to be boldly truthful. All you need is a little bit of truth. That's what most salesmen probably have learned over time. You get someone's attention because they recognize that one little truthful piece, and they assume that since that's something that is true, then the rest of what you say must be true. Like I said, telling people that you understand their pain and that you can also help them determine who's to blame. Those things are also helpful in getting you elected versus somebody else, and that'll be true at local election levels as well as right up to the federal elections. But in the end, you have to sort of put up or shut up, and I think that, you know, the President Trump understands now the hardest job that he will have had was not getting elected president. I mean, he was good at that. He was surrounded by people that understood, you know, what was needed to get there. And now that he's there, he'll discover that the real truthful part is to break everything down to its elemental parts and then put it back together again in a meaningful way that improves what you already have. And the president has a greater challenge now than other presidents before him. If he had genuinely inherited a dismal situation in the economy, in a dismal situation in the United States, if it was really the mess that he likes to present it as, it would be easier for him to present the expectation that he's keeping his promises, his campaign promises. The problem that he's going to have is that things were in good enough shape, non-messy, so to speak, were in good enough shape on the day of his inauguration, that to show some sort of improvement becomes increasingly more difficult because the situation was already in good stead. The hope that it has to be is that everything is transitory, transitional, and what he inherited in reality, the economy and the situation that we have, is something that he can build upon. But you have to be very, very careful when you're in this environment. And I was listening to an economics professor yesterday on the same topic, and he said, "If you're bold and you're arrogant in your effort to improve things, and by not placing great care before your decisions, you throw the baby out with the bathwater." That's the greatest risk the president faces, is that in trying to repair things, including the healthcare system, you know, you can't simply go in and say, okay, get rid of what's already there and then create something brand new. That's never enough. He's going to have to, the toughest part of his job, and it's going to be the toughest part of his Secretary of Health and Human Services job, as well as everything that Congress is doing. And they're already seeing how difficult a job this is going to be just by going home for their congressional break and having to deal with some of these unhappy constituents back home, especially as they try to do these town halls. I mean, that's turned into a disaster. But what he's got to realize is that there are a great many elements of the existing healthcare system that is now in place, whether you want to call it the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, or just make up a new name for it. That's fine. But he's going to have to figure out, first of all, that not everything is bad. So not everything is broken. And there are some genuinely worthwhile elements to the Affordable Care Act. And there are elements that a great many people appreciate and are going to want to keep and are going to become very angry if they lose them. So trying to figure out what works, and a lot works, but more important, then identify what things don't work, what things are too expensive, what things are painful, and then find a way to replace those things with improvements. So the idea is don't get rid of the Affordable Care Act, probably. And I think that a great many politicians, including some conservative friends of mine, are on this page already, where they're saying, you know, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Figure out what does work within the existing plan and simply make it better. And with those improvements in place, eliminate the things that you like least about the Affordable Care Act. That's doable. And it may be a much less expensive approach to health care reform than what a complete repeal and replace would actually represent. I'm not sure that's even a doable thing. And I think that's what really Paul Ryan and the Congress are trying to tell the president at this point. Recent U.S. data continues to show strength. That's the whole thing. The Citigroup Economic Surprise Index holds near its highest levels since 2014. Weekly jobless claims remain near their lowest levels in more than 40 years. It's pretty impressive. The U.S. dollar fell about 0.2% against a basket of currencies, with the euro near 1.05 and the yen at around 1.12. In a meeting with several manufacturing CEOs today, the president said that he wants a weaker dollar, which would benefit U.S. exporters. But the greenback has risen more than 3% since the actual elections on November the 8th. Like you said, if the dollar is very, very expensive and very stronger versus a basket of foreign currencies like the euro and the pound and the yen and a whole bunch of others, if the dollar is too strong, then it makes it really, really hard for U.S. manufacturers to compete against foreign comparable manufacturers who are pricing their products based upon lower currency levels. So it's the currency exchange issue is a big deal for him. And try to blend all of that and deal with a strong dollar and add into that the whole issue of a potential border tax to actually tax products that are imported by Americans. Americans are funky about that. You know, you take a $23,000 car that they would have bought and suddenly make them pay $25,000 or $26,000 because of a tax. I don't know. We're going to have to wait and see. I mean, the public, consumers have a funny way of voting or appreciating or not appreciating because of how things affect their pocketbook. Now, in corporate news, Tesla reported mixed quarterly results, topping revenue estimates but falling short of profit forecasts. Victoria's Secret's parent company, which is L Brands, reported weak forward-looking guidance Wednesday after the close yesterday, sending its stock really tanking by more than 15%, which is this has been a very profitable stock over the last few years. Overseas European equities closed mostly lower. Pan-European stocks index declined about 0.14%. In Asia, the Shanghai Composite fell 0.3%. Nikkei 225 in Japan closed just below the flat line number. Now, of all of the things that you hear about, all of the things that are part of this broad-based discussion of reform and the challenges that the White House is dealing with, and they have to, any plan the White House comes up with, especially on something like tax reform, which is a far broader, bigger, nastier, uglier negotiation as well as overall plan, much bigger deal, much more complicated than some people think just by listening to political rhetoric during a campaign. Now all of a sudden you're going to start hearing various versions of what tax reform can look like. There'll be some coming out periodically from the White House. We hear that. But all we basically hear is just how wonderful and how terrific it's going to be and how it's going to be wonderful for everybody. I think that the first place that you're going to hear meaningful data, in other words, put some meat on the bone again, is probably going to come out of the Congress because Paul Ryan's tax committee has actually been working on this for a very long time and actually trying to create the details that we're desperately looking for as part of this process. And there's multiple elements to it. There's personal tax reform as well as corporate tax reform, and they're not all exactly the same. So anyway, how will corporate tax reform impact the corporate bond market? Again, there's unintended consequences to almost everything that we do out there. So I'm going to take a quick break here at halftime on the Money Talk program. When I get back, we're going to talk a little bit about, you know, what the Republican or Paul Ryan's tax plan actually looks like, and what's the chances of what are the chances that it could work, and is this something the president would be willing to put his name on? This is Money Talk. I'm Don Sowell. We'll be right back. And we welcome you back to the Money Talk program. We mentioned in the first segment of tonight's program that the, needless to say, there are three primary elements to what is the proposals that government will be working on. When I say government, I mean the White House, the Senate, and the House of Representatives. Some of the issues, the players are on the same page. Some of them not quite so much. There'll be some commonality, there'll be some differences, and there can have to be some negotiations going on and maybe some compromise back and forth. It'll be interesting to see how willing all parties are to do so. But the makeup of the House of Representatives and the Congress is very, very different. They may be controlled by the Republicans, but not all of these Republicans are created equal, shall we say. In other words, Republicanism has changed a great deal. Paul Ryan himself comes out of the Tea Party experience, and that would mean that he would be more in line with the fiscal conservative group. Whether he'll be able to work really, really well on all areas of upcoming economic stimulus and growth in the country, the same ones that the president is interested in, or at least I'm not suggesting that I think they all want to get to the same place, but how they get there may be a little bit different. It's going to be an interesting dynamic between these personalities. So, how will corporate tax reform, which is one of the two primary issues here, affect other areas of the economy, including the bond market, which is something that we're interested here in the stock market right here on the Money Talk program? There's some very important implications for both credit markets as well as for certain stock investors. If something like the tax plans of either the House Speaker Paul Ryan or the President eventually become law, this basically breaks down into two categories: implications for corporate quality in implications for corporate decision making. For this particular conversation, we're going to assume a tax plan that lowers the statutory tax rate to about 20%, allows for immediate expensing of capital expenditures. This is at the corporate level. It does not allow expensing of net interest costs, and a border-based system where perhaps there could be taxation of products or services that come across the border back into the U.S. Now, in this particular context, the main difference between Paul Ryan and Donald Trump's plans are that the president would actually allow companies to choose either immediate capital expenditures expensing, CapEx, they call it, immediate expensing or interest expensing down the road. For simplicity, we'll go with what is the Ryan plan for right now. Corporate quality, we mentioned. On balance, more companies would benefit from lower headline rates, that big 20% rate at the top, which is as high as 35% in some areas. Immediate expensing of CapEx and the ability to bring cash back from overseas. Overall, I said more companies would benefit from the ability to do this than would get hurt by the inability to write off their interest expenses. The largest U.S. corporate bond issuer is Verizon. The company paid $4.4 billion in interest payments, dividend payments, in 2016, which it would no longer be able to write off under this rule. But Verizon spent $17 billion in capital expenditures. Hard to know how much of that it was able to expense in year one versus perhaps future years, but it seems pretty obvious that between immediate expensing or lower rates, companies like this would come out ahead in this particular discussion. Now, that isn't every company, of course. Now, lower quality, high yield companies are at risk, of course. Take a triple C rated company such as Monotronix, which provides home alarm systems. It was acquired by Ascent Media in 2010 in a highly levered transaction. In other words, they borrowed money to make the buy. On the face of it, this is the kind of company that can afford to be highly levered. They can afford to be carrying a lot of debt. It gets very steady cash flow and has low capital needs. Effectively, Monotronix act as a middleman between alarm manufacturers and the local dealer who does the actual installations and servicing of the alarms. Now, in the last 12 months, the company had just $7 million in capital expenditures, but it did have $123 million in interest expense. Remember, it borrowed a lot of money as part of the buy, but it is not really spending a lot of money on capital expenses. Realizing some tax savings on its interest cost would surely be part of the calculation when Ascent Media bought the company, I'm sure. As it is, operating cash flow is just about $195 million, meaning that the company is barely covering interest cost right now, and you take away the tax benefit on that interest cost, and this might spell some serious trouble for this company. Again, it's all a question of what the tax code says as to whether this company is profitable or successful or not. I'm only using this as an example, of course, so I'm surely not predicting that they're going to default. There are a number of companies, that you might have owned at one time but do not any longer. So I don't know the intricacies of the particular finances. What I'm trying to point out here is that there is a lot of highly levered, overwhelmingly domestic and low capital intensive businesses out there lurking in the high yield world. Now, these would be in the small and mid-sized company range. But as I mentioned before, interest expenses for that triple C rated company, their interest expense is $123 million. And this is not a company that had a revenue of $195 million. So they don't have a lot of wiggle room if they were to lose the benefit of writing off their interest expense. Now, investors should realize that a relatively small percentage of companies going into default would materially change the returns for junk bond funds. In the worst years for junk bonds, for example, the default rate only gets up to around 10%, was the worst we'd ever seen, which is not that bad, really. Last year, it was literally around 3% was the default rate for junk bond funds. So an increase of just say up to 4% or 5% would get us most of the way to the close to the worst case scenario that we've ever seen. Or if you put it another way, typically junk bond investors lose 70% on every default. So a 5% increase in defaults would be a roughly 3.5% hit on their actual returns. Now, the problem might be more acute in the syndicated bank loan market that's out there. Floating rate loan bonds, loan funds, have been an extremely popular way to play rising interest rates in recent years. Companies doing large leveraging transactions are overrepresented in the loan market, and hence this might be a more vulnerable spot. So a number of those companies that are in that particular category that are highly leveraged would have a lot of interest expense to deal with. So how that is taxed and how that's handled under tax reform will matter. The problem might be more acute, as I said, in that particular category. I don't think you want to passively own high yield, however, in the environment we're in right now with the junk bonds. The tax-related risk is just one of many reasons that you'd be concerned, the principle being that valuations can be pretty difficult in this environment. There are individual high-yield bonds worth owning, of course, but maybe you don't want to own the entire market. You can buy an ETF, which is an exchange-traded fund that owns junk bonds, and the symbol, believe it or not, is JNK. How's that for a great symbol? But you might not want to buy a big basket like that. Again, be more selective, looking at credit quality, looking at the actual companies. Tax reform could have wide-ranging implications for corporate strategies of many kinds, but in terms of what matters to the bond market, it comes down to whether the change in taxation results in less debt funding. The claim some make is that debt financing is effectively subsidized by allowing it to be written off as an expense. So that expense allowance tends to subsidize that market. If something is subsidized, you're getting more of it than you otherwise would get. So in this category, I'm highly skeptical that this is going to matter much at all. The vast majority of companies face much higher cost of equity funding versus the cost of debt funding. Take semiconductor company Micron Technologies. It has a cost of equity capital that's about 13.2% on its book. Now, on an after-tax basis, the company's average cost of debt capital is around 2.9%. Even if we assumed a statutory marginal rate of 35%, the tax rate, Micron's cost of debt would only be around 4%. If it couldn't write anything off, it would still be around 4%. That's still far lower than the 13.2% cost of equity. So even more damning is the fact that Micron's effective tax rate is just 6%. After tax rates, average tax rates aren't the same as marginal rates, but we can safely assume that Micron's marginal rate is probably well below the 35%, which is the maximum corporate rate. So the delta, the difference between today's tax regime today and Paul Ryan's, just in terms of cost of debt, is probably going to be a minimal difference. In other words, Micron would probably be making the same balance sheet decisions regardless of what kind of tax policy we have out there. Now, this could have a material impact on companies doing leveraged buyouts or similar types of transactions out there. Some of those transactions wouldn't work at all if the net cost of debt were higher, but this has been a pretty small part of bond issuance the last few years. I could see, you know, there being some, say, impacts on niche parts of the market, such as the aforementioned bank loans or the business development companies that are out there. But even there, I think that the effect of issuance would be long-term and pretty minor overall. We would be cautious on how much we actively bet on any particular tax regime coming out, whether it's Paul Ryan's or whether it's the president's. There's a lot of politics yet to play out on this. And in the case of high-yield bonds, for example, I think valuation is a good enough reason to get out. I think the high-yield bonds are in a category right now where they're expensive and you might not want to own them necessarily. And this particular tax-related risk is just one more reason to be trimming those positions right now. I'd be very careful chasing any company that is being driven up on hopes of a more favorable tax regime. We just don't know what exactly is coming. And I think that we have to have a whole host of data points before we start looking at tax issues as a reason for you to buy or sell a particular stock. Hey, folks, this is the Money Talk program. We're going to be right back after this brief break, so please stick around. And we welcome you back to the Money Talk program. I just saw a really interesting study that was provided by the Kaiser Family Foundation. And this deals with the issue of the Affordable Care Act. You get the impression from, of course, the Republican campaign for president and the success that Donald Trump enjoyed in his campaign, that this issue of repeal and replace would be at the forefront of the desire of the vast majority of Americans, or at very least the vast majority of those who voted for Donald Trump. And of course, now with the Republicans controlling both the House, both houses of Congress, and Donald Trump in the Oval Office, it's just you assume it's just a matter of time before big changes are made to the current health law of the land. The big question, though, is just how swiftly these changes should be made, or if they should be made at all. In mid-December, the Kaiser Foundation asked respondents from around the country what should be done with the ACA, or Affordable Care Act, considering the relatively consistent dislike that a lot of people seem to have for Obamacare over nearly 7 years of the Kaiser Foundation's polling. Those numbers showed that level of dislike. You might presume that an immediate repeal and replace of that law was the most popular pick for the respondents, but you'd be wrong. So this is how it really came down. 47% of those polled suggest that they would not vote to repeal at all. So that's not a majority, but it's a big number. 28% said that you should wait to vote to repeal the law until details of the replacement plan have been announced. Now, that makes a lot of sense. 20% vote to repeal the law immediately and work out the details of a replacement plan later, and the other 5% have no clue. Now, even though the net percentage of people suggesting that Obamacare be repealed is slightly higher than the percentage who would like the law not to be repealed at all, just 1 in 5 Americans want to see the law repealed immediately. Now, this opinion is likely shared by so few people, because there's real concern that repealing Obamacare and not having a replacement plan in place could cause roughly 20 million plus Americans to actually lose their health insurance, which could have a rather bizarre set of unintended consequences. Those who are the most at risk, of course, include lower income individuals and families that relied on premium and cost sharing subsidies, as well as persons with pre-existing conditions that prior to Obamacare couldn't get health insurance of any kind at all. There's also no real concrete indication what path Republicans are going to take in rolling back Obamacare. Repealing the ACA would be probably the preferred method, but it would also require 60 votes in the Senate, which Republicans currently don't have. Instead, Republicans may choose to go with what they call reconciliation, which would allow them to strip components of Obamacare that seem to impact on the federal budget by a simple majority vote. Now, what you may not realize is that Republicans do have an Obamacare replacement plan gaining some steam in the Republican-controlled House of Representatives. In late January, Senator Rand Paul actually introduced an Obamacare Replacement Act, which offered a number of key changes from the current health law. You can read about that in Rand Paul's plan in more intricate detail, online. But, arguably, the aspect of the replacement plan that consumers may be happiest about is that it'll protect individuals with pre-existing conditions from being denied coverage by reinstituting HIPAA, which is the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act from 1996, pre-existing condition provisions. This would probably relieve consumers who fear losing coverage because of a chronic condition. Perhaps the biggest change, however, aside from the obvious elimination of the ACA itself and the commensurate subsidies that accompanied it, would be the strong emphasis on health savings accounts, HSAs. An HSA is a tax-advantaged account that allows individuals and families to pay for qualified medical expenses on a tax-free, penalty-free basis. Paul's plan, Rand Paul's plan, would allow for a tax credit of up to, say, $5,000 annually for money contributed into an HSA. But more importantly, it would remove the cap on the total amount that could be contributed annually, encouraging consumers to invest heavily in their HSA accounts. It's more complicated than that, folks. We don't have time to go into all the details. We want you to know that there are, in fact, plans being created out there, even before the repeal goes through. So waiting for the plans to emerge before repeal may be the direction the Republicans take. We'll see. I'm Don Sowa. This has been Money Talk. Thanks for tuning in. Tune in tomorrow at 5. Steve Bovay will be here to close out the week with more Money Talk. Have a good night.